This is Build and Analyze episode number 19. It's a weekly news and discussion show. It's about the world of the iPhone, iPad, iOS in general. Sometimes we talk about Android, sure, and the web, mobile web development, why not? Whatever you can think of. It's hosted by Marco Arment, who just happens to have created Instapaper and co-founded Tumblr, knows what he's talking about. I'm Dan Benjamin. Sometimes I know what I'm talking about. And today, we got a lot to talk about, actually. I mean, I know two or three of the items on your list, Marco. Just off the top of my head, I know.
Right, and it definitely wouldn't be because I just told you a few is before the show.
No, it's psychic.
Right, oh yeah, definitely.
It's psychic. And we'd like to just, up front, we'd like to say thanks to FreshBooks.com and MailChimp.com. We have something exciting to tell you about each one of those things, each one of those sponsors in during the show. I don't want to spoil the surprise, but there is cake involved.
Everyone loves cake.
Yeah.
Except for that PHP framework. I'm not a big fan of that.
What? See, that would be, please add that to your list. Let's talk about PHP frameworks at some point.
Unfortunately, I'm really not qualified to talk about PHP frameworks because I've never really used one that I didn't write. I used cake for like 2 months in 2006. So I'm sure it's probably that's fine,
like,
really.
That's like, well, I smoked, but I didn't inhale.
Yeah, you know, I thought that was the point.
I tried it, but I didn't actually launch a site with it.
Okay. This was a consulting project that I did for with David right before we made Tumblr for this horrible company that I won't even mention because it was so horrible.
Oh, so you were doing like consulting work and stuff before that?
Yeah, originally when David hired me in 2006, he hired me to work with him on consulting projects. That's his business.
Oh.
And Tumblr was this idea he had later that fall in late 2006 that we just did when we had like a free week with no client work. He's like, hey, I've had this idea for a while, and I bought the domain. Let's give it a shot before next week when we have to start Next New Network.
That's so cool.
So that's how Tumblr started. Was, you know, David had this idea, and we had a free week. And that was it.
It always seems to be that way.
Yep. You know, there's always some guy named David, and you know, you need an idea,
right.
and you need Next New Network to not want your services for another week. And that's how all products are born. It's a very common story.
I like you caffeinated better. I'm glad that we do the show in the afternoon now. you're much more exciting when you're caffeinated.
I didn't dislike myself.
The other Marco. I didn't dislike that.
Well, see, I can't listen to this. I told you this before. Like, I hear all of my vocal flaws. I hear whenever I stutter or whenever I mispronounce something or just, you know, I trip over my mouth in a word. And I just really can't listen to the show. And So Webstock just posted the videos of the talks, and I tried watching the first few minutes of mine to see how I did, and I couldn't watch it. I had to stop. It was unbearable.
Oh,
like
really?
If I watched the whole thing, I'm not sure I would ever speak again. It was horrible. But I suggest watching other people's talks at least, especially if you're going to watch Merlin's. Merlin's talk was at the end of the conference, and it was the closer. And I suggest that you, if you're going to watch more than one Webstock talk, watch his last.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it makes a lot of sense as a closer. And it really, I think it hits home more. Because he kind of references some of the earlier talks and some of the earlier speakers. I think it's more effective if you watch it the way it actually was relative to the other. So watch it at the end after you've seen like some other really, you know, high big name people, because then he talks about it and it actually makes it more interesting and more meaningful.
Where was your talk in relation to the order?
Mine was a two days of talks, and mine was the first talk on the second day. So it was first thing in the morning. I had a whole day to see everyone else's talks and get really nervous about mine. And then I feel really bad for Frank Shimero. He went first. And he had never, like, most of the speakers had never attended this conference either. So we really didn't know what to expect. Frank Shimero gets up there. He was booked like a week ahead of time. no more than that. And he went up there and killed it. He was so freaking good. And he had to go first on the very first day. So that was really impressive. I was blown away. And that's one of the reasons I got so nervous. Like, everybody was so good. I was after the first day, I'm like, oh crap.
You know, but imagine the pressure of speaking last, of being the closing act, of having to follow up so many great people. You almost have to top them. The pressure on that, it's got to be crazy. You have to, I mean, Merlin consistently, he tells people that he cried. You almost have to cry if you're closing.
Oh yeah, and but he didn't cry for like more than 2 seconds. I mean, yeah. I think everyone in the audience was crying too. So
I cry every time I go up on stage.
I want to cry afterwards and before, certainly. Anyway, so I do have two quick coffee topics to talk about today.
Oh, great. Finally.
I know. It's been so long since we talked about coffee. And our listeners have been emailing us saying, please, we need more coffee.
Right.
Please don't put it into its own show. Please continue shoving it into this one, and we just want to hear more of it. So the first is I want to thank Randy for sending me a pound of Kona coffee from Hawaii. Kona coffee, normally I tried Kona only a couple times in the past, and it's exceptionally smooth. But the problem with that is that it doesn't have a lot of the like kind of the high notes, like the acidy or berry like tastes that I really like from the African coffees. Like my favorite is always Kenya, and Ethiopia is a close second. I love like the kind of berry notes they have, and Kona is exceptionally smooth and doesn't have any of those like flavor peaks. And so it's for a different audience. It's for people who don't like those peaks. Like for example, if you're a big fan of cold brewed coffee, like for, you know, the iced coffee in the summertime and everything, if you use like the toddy or like just the, any kind of cold brew method, it almost always doesn't extract any of those high notes from the beans. And a lot of people like that better. I usually don't. So I was skeptical of Kona because in the past I've always thought it was a very good version of a style of coffee I'm not a big fan of. But this was actually really good. I was very surprised. This was the best Kona I've ever had by far. And it was, I'd say, probably in my top 3 or 4 coffees I've ever had. So I was very, very happy. So thanks, Randy. Second thing is this week there was this cool project on Kickstarter called Coffee Joulies. And that's spelled like the energy unit, Joule, J-O-U-L-I-E-S.
Yeah.
And it's a cool idea. And at first I was like, wait, should that work? But it actually does. So the idea is they're kind of like these almost like ice cube kind of things, but made of metal and shaped like coffee beans. And inside of them is a phase exchange material that is specially designed to have its melting point from solid to liquid at about 140 degrees Fahrenheit, which they think is the ideal coffee drinking temperature. You know, because obviously when you first brew it, it's a lot harder than that. And then you taste it, you burn your tongue, and then you're like, oh, okay, this is too hot. Let me set it down for a few minutes. And then you come back 15 minutes later and it's too cold. So the idea with these is you drop them in the cup, and they absorb a lot of heat on the temperatures way down from 140. When they reach 140, the material inside melts, and the phase change lasts a little while. And so if you remember, like in high school science class, when you would bring water to a boiler, you know, whenever you'd boil or melt anything, the Bunsen burner in chemistry class. You know, when you'd raise the water temperature to 212, but then as it's transforming to steam, it stays at 212 for a while because the change of the phase itself takes some of the heat.
Like, yeah, who doesn't remember that? Who doesn't remember high school chemistry class?
Of course. Well, this is like introduction to science. Now, I admit I had to look this up on Wikipedia because I had to look up. I knew it worked on the way up, and I guess that has to work on the way down. But I just wanted to look up to make sure I was saying the right thing here today. Because I knew like, okay, if you're heating it up and then you want to make it hotter than the boiling temperature, you have to give it a bunch of energy to get past that transition, and then it starts climbing again. But yeah, so it turns out I verified, thanks Wikipedia, that it actually does work the same way on the way down. And so the idea is these things absorb lots of heat from the coffee to bring it back down to 140. And then at 140, as the material in them melts, it's probably some kind of wax thing according to Wikipedia. But as the material inside of them melts, it keeps the temperature of the surrounding liquid at 140 for a little while until it's all the way melted. And then it absorbs more of the heat from the coffee, and then it brings it down below 140 until it reaches some kind of equilibrium, I guess. Anyway, so it's a good idea, I think. And while I don't think I'll be using them the way they intend, what I do intend, I intend to preheat them because I like keeping my coffee hot for longer, and bring it down to drinkable temperature is less of a priority for me. I'd rather just have it stay hot longer. So I intend to basically what I'll do is I will pour, like when I'm boiling the water for the AeroPress, when it's almost boiled, I'll make some extra, and then I'll pour some out into a separate cup that has these things in it to kind of preheat them for a little while. Then I'll finish the whole AeroPress process, which does not take 8 minutes. And it takes a lot less than that once you're at that point. And then a few minutes later, I will take them out and put them into my real coffee cup, at which point they'll be very hot and help keep it hot for a lot longer than had I not used them. So I'm hoping these things work out. They look really cool. Like they look like little coffee beans, and it's a nice stainless steel design. I hope they end up looking that cool in real life.
I like magic beans.
Sure. I don't know. What? Yeah, probably. That's probably a reference I'm not getting.
Well, you know, magic beans. You know, like Jack and the Beanstalk.
Oh, yeah. Well, those, I mean, I'm guessing those probably weren't made out of stainless steel.
Well, we don't know. There's a lot of speculation going on.
And I'm not sure that phase change material was fully understood back then.
No, nor is it still.
Right, exactly. I'm sure we're going to get lots of emails saying which part of this I got completely wrong. Sorry about that. Anyway.
Well, should we give them a preview? There's a few things I know we've got to talk about that are not coffee related.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's pretty much done. I'm pretty much done with the coffee there.
Okay. Are you sure?
Yeah, I think. Well, for this episode, okay. For now.
Okay.
Maybe later. Maybe in the after dark area.
We can sure. Yeah, definitely.
So I want to talk about Will Shipley's post. This was really good this week. I don't know the exact title, but the topic is farming versus mining.
Right.
And it's about...
I think the title was Success and Farming versus Mining.
Oh, bingo. Okay. So Will Shipley is a well-established software developer in the Mac world, and he's been doing it for a very long time, and he's very good at it. And he's in particular very good at what I consider the normal way of doing things and what I think VCs would consider the old way of doing things,
uh-huh.
Which is you charge money for a product and you spend less than you make. And the very simple way of doing business because it works and because it's sensible and it's simple. As opposed to the VC model of you give everything away for free, you raise a bunch of money to pay for it all from venture capitalists, and then you figure out how to make money later, which may or may not actually happen. And the overall idea really isn't to build a business that you're going to be at for 10 years, but rather to sell to somebody else, like some big company like Google, make a lot of money, stay there the minimum amount of time that your contract requires, and then quit and start a new thing. So Will compares the former model to farming a plot of land and the latter model to mining it. Where farming, you're really trying to build something long term. You don't really abuse the land. You have to work at it. You have to keep working at it.
Right. You might not make a lot of money right away, but in the long haul, it will be a nice profitable business that might even be a successful business.
Exactly. If you just have to keep working at it, work hard, and it will pay off over time, and usually a lot more steadily and reliably. Whereas mining. And hence the VC model, which he compared to mining, is like you kind of go in there, blow everything up really quickly, just try to get as much value as quickly as possible with very little concern for long term goals in most cases, or long term viability, and because you don't intend to be there long term.
Right.
I think this is a really good post, and I think everyone should read it. Everyone in the world should read it. And at least as long as you can read English and don't hate software.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very interesting. It's not that the VC model is inherently bad all the time. Like it's not, you can't have a blanket statement saying VC is bad. Because VC is necessary in a lot of industries and a lot of cases where there's big capital needed up front to get a product started before you can make any money. For example, if you wanted to build a new search engine today, a new web search engine just from scratch, and the idea was to index a significant amount of web content, you would need a lot of capital up front to just build that index, to buy all the hardware, to have a lot of engineering talent and a lot of engineering time to devote to that, just to build like the very first index before you even have a product that anybody's going to want to use. And so when you have that kind of big expense required up front, it's difficult to do that in the traditional model because, like, you, if you have to start charging money or running profitable ads on something from day one, it has to be pretty useful from day one. And so in that kind of case, it wouldn't be. So that's difficult. And the other thing is, you know, in the other model, in the farming model, you know, of charging money for something from the beginning and just building a sustainable business, that kind of makes some assumptions. Like, one of the assumptions is that your initial costs are going to be very, very, very low, which is great if you're a programmer and you want to have a you know, a side project maybe from your full-time job. Your cost really is your time. And if you're a programmer, you can do what is usually the most expensive part of building a website or a software product, which is the programming part of it. You can do that yourself effectively for free monetarily, but, you know, you're really spending your time on it. But there's no venture capital really needed for that if you can do all the work yourself or most of it. And then maybe you might need a little bit of money for design or web hosting or things like that, but it's usually not a massive amount of money if you can do all the programming for free. So that's especially in something like a website or an iPhone app where the needs for design and advertising and other resources that are not programming can be fairly low to start. Not saying you don't need those things ever, but you can get a useful product out there without spending a lot with people. So anyway, I think this is a great article. It's a great way to look at the industry. And one thing he says is, I think he distinguishes not necessarily that that the farming versus the mining, like either of them are ever always the right answer, but that people who work in the industry, who work at these companies or who make these companies, usually only want to do one or the other thing. And it's difficult for somebody who wants one of the other models to work in the other one, you know, like it's and to be happy in it. And that's, I think that's one of the reasons why you see after the big company acquisition of a lot of these things, the founders leave as soon as they can. Because when a big company acquires the product, they could do a few bad things to it to make you not like them as much.
Yeah.
But in all likelihood, you're just itching to get out of there because you want to go start the next big thing. Because your business is start things as much as possible, blow them up as quickly as possible, and then get out and do the next thing. That's the kind of person you are. That's what you like to do. Whereas the idea of working on the same project for 10 years and just doing incremental updates that make people happy and trying to make a lot of money from it or just trying to make any money from it enough to pay your expenses, a lot of people really don't want to do that. They are not interested or they're just not very good at it. So they're better suited to one or the other. So I think it's important to see that distinction. What do you think?
Do you agree with one or the other? Do you think he nails those as the two options that there are? Is there a third? Is there anything else?
Probably. Yeah, that's a really good point.
Is there an in-between line to walk?
I think there is. So one of the in-between lines, which I think is perfectly sensible, is if you're using venture capital for like an expansion or for really a temporary thing, like the traditional model of venture capital on the web that most of us think about is kind of the Twitter model, which is, and I don't know if this is still the case at Twitter, who knows, but it's like you pretty much, and YouTube did the exact same thing, you pretty much raise money from the beginning, you give everything away for free, you have no or close to no income, and you just assume that you'll figure it all out later. And I think that is the that's kind of, it can't work. It has worked, obviously, but it creates some problems and it creates some weird incentives. Where the other way to do it, I think, is what venture capital is good for. Not only the upfront of, you know, doing something very expensive, but let's say you had a business and you saw a great opportunity for expansion, but you had to expand more quickly than your income would allow. Maybe you're about to embark on a really big business and you got to hire like a big sales team or like, you know, you got to hire a bunch of engineers and you already, you know, maybe you already have an established business that is profitable or close to it, or maybe you maybe you're starting out, but you only intend to have like one little round of VC to get you started. So you take the VC to get you over that hump of quick expansion, and then you don't need it anymore.
Right. Or maybe if you wanted to manufacture something and you knew that you needed a specialized, you know, factory component, or you needed something big that you need in a way to kind of put the cart before the horse just a little bit to build this thing.
Right.
You can't just sit down and write some code, or maybe that's only part of it, that there's some other financial obstacle, and the only way that you can accomplish it is by it. And it's not the kind of thing that you say, well, you know, me and my partner need money to pay our bills. That's an angel investment. You know, we need to be able to pay our bills for 6 months while we build it. That's angel investment. That's not VC.
Right. Although I honestly don't really distinguish that much between those two. I think they can both kind of serve in similar roles. I know, okay, incoming hate mail on that too, but I really think
from me
that I think angel versus VC, there isn't that much difference. They're both providing a big chunk of money up front when the prospect of making money later is uncertain. You know, I mean, obviously no one knows when a business is going to succeed or fail. I think with VC, I mean, again, I know very little about the VC world, but it seems to me right now as a casual outside observer that there's a big oversupply of VC money right now. Like the VCs want to invest in lots of things and there aren't enough people taking their money or taking enough of it. That's the feeling I get. That could be totally wrong.
So listen, we'd like to thank FreshBooks.com for sponsoring today's episode. I love these guys. I've recently switched for the longest time, Mark, I was doing all my own invoicing, like with from QuickBooks. And it's a nightmare because how do you do it? What's the process? Now, you know, QuickBooks has its ups and downs. The main reason I like QuickBooks in the past, or kind of had to use it, was because my accountant forced me to use it. But finally, I broke free from that. And so now I'm doing everything with FreshBooks. And what's nice about it is it's like everything is in one place. You just create the invoice. It handles sending it, delivering it. It lets you know which ones have been paid and which ones aren't. It makes it very easy to actually manage that stuff, as opposed to like, oh, did I email the invoice to them or not? Did I forget to do that? Did they pay me back? You have no way to know. So FreshBooks handles all of this stuff for you. And these are the guys that are giving away the cakes. Do you remember the cakes?
Yeah. In fact, I was really hoping they were ice cream cakes.
They're not ice cream cakes, as far as I know, because they have to be shipped. So I got an email. Brian Yarger, hope I'm saying that right. He emailed me. He says, I signed up for FreshBooks through your show, and I was one of the winners of a cake. I got it in the mail this afternoon. What a nice gesture from them. Not only do they have an awesome product for someone like me who does consulting on the side, but they send out cakes and sponsor 5x5. And we appreciate that they do this. So they actually were sending out so many cakes that they said, you know, we got to scale this back to one a week now, because they were sending out like hundreds and hundreds of cakes. So you can still get a cake.
And that's still a lot of cakes.
It's a lot of cakes.
You go even to one a week. That's a lot of cakes.
You go to FreshBooks.com and you sign up for the account, which is free. And all you need to do to potentially win one of these cakes is enter this show name, Build and Analyze, in the How Do You Hear About Us section. And that's it. And then you could still win a cake. But here's the one thing I want to emphasize. It's one thing to go there and sign up. But like I said, it's free when you start out, and you actually should try to do some invoicing with it. Actually use it. Because I personally, this is what happened with me. I used it and I said, man, I can't go back to the old way. I can't go back to the old way. So go check it out. FreshBooks.com. Let them know we sent you.
Sounds great. You can even send me an invoice and I'll just ignore it and you can test it out.
That's right. Send Marco an invoice if you want to test it out. Send Marco.
You can invoice me for your time of listening to the show.
That's right. And Swilliams in the chat room wants to know what your definition of a big chunk of money is.
It depends on the industry. I mean, in our industry, you know, if you're trying to build up a new web service, for instance, I think usually a big chunk of money is between $500,000 and $1 million for a very early round. And then maybe a few million if you already have a few employees and you want to operate for a while and maybe you're getting some usage, stuff like that. Usually, I think the initial rounds for like making a website or a web service are usually under $1 million, but not by much, or near $1 million. But you know, that's the idea with that is usually like you don't have any hope of making money for possibly like 2 years. And so you want to know if you can keep operating for the next 18 months or something like that. Like how much money do you need to operate at that? And then you have to project, are you going to grow? Are your expenses going to grow? You have to cover that. It's tough. And I'm not anywhere near an expert on this at all. So I should really stop talking about it. But the basic idea is VC money in our industry is often used to finance things that it's a pretty big stretch to figure out how they're going to ever make money. Or it's based on a lot of assumptions. Like you assume, for instance, that at some point you will have monetizable product. So are you going to have so many people using it that ads become very valuable? If you look at something like Facebook, for instance, I think they kind of lucked out because they just got so many people that it ironed out a lot of these problems. But Facebook's context isn't really conducive to ad click-through rates and to valuable advertising, whereas a Google search is very different. A Google search is you are looking for something specific. It very well might be a product or something related to a product or in some way related to spending money. For instance, if you're looking for a coupon to a nearby restaurant, or if you're looking for a new coffee maker for your office. I'm talking about coffee again. Oh well. If you search Google for those things, it is in an advertiser's best interest to pay to be on that page because you have a purchasing intent. And then if you click like, and then in that context, ads are relevant to you. The ads might actually be what you're looking for. And then you can, you know, click on that. The advertiser pays Google, and then you go to the advertiser's site. And because of what you were doing when you got there, the context in which you found it, where you were advertised to, you are fairly likely to buy something or to spend money or to do something the advertiser really wanted you to do. Whereas if you're on Facebook or even if you're browsing a website somewhere, just browsing somebody's blog or a newspaper or anything like that, the ads there are mostly hoping to distract you. And so there's little purchasing intent there. And so the ad there is going to be worth a lot less to the advertiser because people who click on that aren't really in the context of being in a purchasing mindset or of, you know, being about to spend money or about to do whatever they want you to do. In that kind of context, they're just kind of casually browsing and maybe they accidentally clicked on your ad trying to click on something else, or maybe they thought it was a button and they clicked on it, or maybe they actually are interested but just very passively, whereas they're not searching Google for like local Nissan dealerships. They're just browsing Facebook and like, hey, look, there's a new car that looks kind of cool. So if you are basing your long-term monetization goals on the assumption that ads are going to be worth something, you have to think about the context of, you know, where are you going to put these ads and what mindset are people going to be in when they see them? Because if you're just hoping to distract people, that's going to be worth a lot less. You're going to get far lower click-through rates. You're going to get far lower impression rates and impression payments, CPMs, and that might torpedo your whole model. And you assume that somebody along the lines of VC would tell you, hey, you know, you got to adjust that assumption here and here, but that doesn't always happen. And there's so much VC money trying to be invested in things that a lot of times they get a little bit sloppy and they invest in things that they probably shouldn't. And the other weird thing is VC really perverts the marketplace for whatever they're investing in. So, for instance, if I probably shouldn't talk about Tumblr specifically, but let's say you were starting a new publishing platform today and you wanted to charge money for certain features. Let's say you wanted to charge money for like queued posting or drafts or, you know, some kind of advanced feature, maybe being able to edit the slug on permalinks, like stuff like that, like features that most users aren't going to use, but like the pro bloggers would use. The problem is if you start charging for those things, some other venture capital based startup is going to give them away for free to take all your customers if you get a lot of customers. So if you're in an industry where there's a lot of venture capital based startups happening in this kind of traditional bad way of just giving everything away for free, it's very hard for anybody in that startup to be competitive because someone else is going to come along. It's like a labor market where there's no minimum wage. Like someone else is going to come along and do that for free. And so you can't differentiate yourself only on features in those kinds of markets. And like in a big case, this kind of happens whenever Google invades the space. But like remember right before Google Calendar came out, there were like three or four pretty good web calendar startups. It was just getting started. The market was just starting for like nice, you know, Ajaxy, which at the time meant something. Nice web startups that were having these nice, pretty calendars, and then Google came out with a free one, and it just crushed the entire market. The market was gone overnight.
Yeah,
and you know, the same kind of thing happens in the VC world. Like any market right now, where people are paying for something, chances are a VC startup is going to either already has or is going to come in and offer that same thing for free, and it's going to crush the market in all likelihood. So it's VC. It's a weird thing in our industry, and it really does cause a lot of problems. And I think this is a lot of what Will was getting at, not just the incentives of what you're doing and the people building it, but the problems it causes for the other players in the market. It's hard to be a farmer in a market full of miners in this, because the miners are going to come in and, you know, set the whole place on fire and ruin everything for everyone else who's just trying to earn a decent living. And anyway, this is probably taking the metaphor way too far, but that's kind of the gist of it, and that's probably enough said on that, I guess. I don't know. What do you think
about this whole picture of mining and farming, or beyond that?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah, I don't know.
You know, I think there's basically two ways to look at this. I don't see it as an either or necessarily. I don't know. You know, I've been part of startups that took a whole lot of VC, many, many millions of dollars, and seen them completely mismanage it and implode. And I've seen that a couple times. Even with people who in some cases had an incredibly successful track record and were themselves millionaires and knew what they were doing, I've still seen it fail. And in some cases, because of external forces. So, you know, I've also seen people, you know, like Will Shipley, who have, you know, had an idea and spent years and years working on it and perfecting it. And I'll tell you why I think Will Shipley's post is so popular. I'll tell you why, because it's been read. He told me yesterday, he said, oh, my post has been read, you know, 30,000 times in the last 12 hours or something like that. Which, you know, that's a lot. That's a lot of traffic, unless you're, you know, unless you're Marco or John Gruber.
That'd be a lot for me too.
Well, it's a lot. And it was, you know, highly regarded on Hacker News. And I'll tell you why I think the developer community really likes his post. And I told him this too. I'll tell you here, because most developers out there, at least the ones that I know that I talk to every single day, most of them in their dreams, they're thinking, yeah, man, it'd be awesome to have some, you know, VC thing and have some cool company. But the reality of it is most people, and probably most people listening to this show, I think they're probably working hard every single day writing software. Maybe it's for themselves or their own little startup or their friends or they're just part of some company writing code. And they love the idea that it's possible to do what they're doing and write code 8, 10, 12 hours a day or every waking moment, like Will Shipley says, because they enjoy it and because they like it. And that at the end of that, if they stick to it and they work really hard and they build something great, that going through those normal channels, that there's something, that there is a fairness that will acknowledge that hard work and that eventually they'll be a millionaire like Will Shipley too. I think that's very appealing to most developers.
I think that's very appealing to most people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a broader...
Hard work pays off, right? That's what your parents tell you.
Right. I mean, in reality, it doesn't always. In fact, in many cases, it really doesn't. But I think that... I think part of the whole American dream ethos, which I think he actually mentions in the post, maybe not by name, is that everyone always looks at the really successful people who they see on TV and et cetera, and they aspire to be like that, and they have a hope that someday they will be like that. This is one of the reasons why it's very difficult in America for any politician to raise taxes on the rich, even though most of the people in the country aren't the rich. It's it's because almost everyone thinks that someday they will be rich, and so therefore they want to keep the interests of the rich in mind for when they get there. And of course, in reality, it doesn't really happen, or it happens to a very, very few people. But that aspirational optimism really influences a lot of the culture and unfortunately, a lot of the policy. But I think you're right. I think that's one of the reasons why this is popular, is because it's telling people, if you work hard, you can be very successful too. Unfortunately, it's actually a lot more complicated than that. Like, if you work hard at the wrong place or on the wrong things, it's not going to do anything for you. You just get laid off, and then you'll have a weird resume full of this big 20-year stretch where it seems like you didn't do that much. It's weird. And that's a whole other discussion right there.
Yeah.
Those kinds of problems. But I think there's an important distinction here. In Will's case, he was working hard for himself.
Right.
If you're working hard for someone else, if your hard work makes someone else a lot of money, if it succeeds, and you don't have any stake or much of a stake in it, like if your hard work means that at your next performance review you might get a 1.5% raise instead of a 1% raise, that's you're never going to get to the place he's talking about. You're never going to be rich. You're never going to be. What he's calling successful, you can never get there by working for someone else. You really have to have your own thing, or at least a big chunk of equity in another thing. And I mean, while we're on this topic, I might as well keep talking about money here. Quick little tip for really any programmers: if you want a significant raise, you have to change jobs. You will never. In most cases, I mean, sometimes there are exceptions, but for the most part, if you go in somewhere and you're making, let's say you go in at 50 grand, if you're making 50 grand somewhere, you will never be able to negotiate that up to like 80 or 100. Like, you're never gonna make that high of a jump. This is one of the reasons why it's very, very important to negotiate a high starting salary when you're starting a new job. And it's almost always negotiable. Don't let anybody tell you it's not. Because whatever you say is your starting salary, you're effectively locking in your baseline for the entire time you're going to be working there. Because everything, any raise that you ask for, or if they're regularly scheduled, any kind of regular raise that you're going to get at a place, it's going to be based on that starting salary. It's going to be a percentage above that, or they're going to think of that as the anchor point for what you're worth, and they're going to think of everything relative to that. So it's extremely important when you get a new job to start out as high as you can get. Whatever you think you can get, ask for 10 grand more at least.
Nice.
Because there's no harm in asking for more. They're not going to like withdraw the job offer if you ask for more money. You know, like, in fact, they might even respect you more because they will think you're worth more because you are telling them this is what you're worth. Really, it's really, really important to do this. You have to negotiate very, very high at the beginning. Because then it becomes a lot easier. First of all, if you negotiate high, not only are the percentage increases then more over time, you know, by definition, but you're telling them right up front, I am worth a premium. I am this good, and I'm confident enough to tell you I'm this good, and so I can start high. And then when you have a future raise, they're still thinking of that. They're still thinking this person is good, and they're worth a lot. You know, assuming they agree to that, to a good salary up front. By the way, and the thing is, if let's say you ask for like, let's say you go into a job and you're like, I want 50,000. The worst possible case is they say, okay. Because then you're like, well, crap, I could have gotten more.
Yeah.
Like, you want them to negotiate. So whatever you want, offer 10,000 or ask them to get for 10,000 more than what you want, or, you know, different percentages in different places probably, but ask them for a big chunk more than what you actually think you can get. And then they'll negotiate it down.
Marco, don't you run the risk then of potentially, you know, making them afraid to offer you something because it's so much lower, and now they'll feel like they're insulting you?
That's only a risk if your initial estimate of what you're worth is way off. If your initial estimate of what you think you can get is way too high. But you usually will have some idea of what you think you can get. And so what I'm saying is, whatever you think you can get, ask for a lot. Ask for an increment more than that, that you expect them to negotiate downwards, but that will still be higher than what you thought you could get. So if you think you can get 50, ask for 65. And they'll say, oh, we can't really do that. How about 60? Then you're still ahead, you know? Like, so you got to do that. You have to negotiate. Like, go in there thinking you're worth a lot, but, you know, not, you know, what you said is important, you know, not so unreasonable that it's impossible for them to pay that. But give them a number that they can easily negotiate down from by a relatively small increment and then offer you that, because then you'll still be ahead. You will know you're getting a bargain because you're getting $10,000 more than you thought you were going to get. And they'll think they're getting a good deal because they negotiated you down a bit so that they could afford you. So it works out for everybody.
All right.
Yeah.
How many jobs have you had?
Full-time, I guess, 2.
That's not a lot. I mean, you managed to do pretty well for yourself with just 2 jobs.
I mean, you know, not counting the current one, which is, you know, me working at home.
Yeah.
Just 2, I guess.
Okay, I was a consultant, what you would call a consultant, where I had really no permanent job. Like, I was an employee of a consulting company and would just go to one contract, work there for 6 months or a year, work at another place for 6 months or a year. I did that quite a bit. Got pretty good at the whole negotiation thing for salaries.
Probably a lot better than I am.
Well, the advice that I would give is don't be afraid to talk about money. It's very important. And usually people are so, in this country anyway, you go to another country and they don't care. They'll talk about it. But in this country, people are like, well, I'd like to earn, you know, 50 grand a year, 50,000. Like, yeah. Oh, great, because we were going to pay you 75, but
yeah,
that's awesome.
I'll tell you that. Yeah. Yeah, there. I was listening to your Pipeline interview with Mike Montero about that, and that was really good.
He knows how to tell it like it is. And a lot, I mean, if you have that attitude going in, you'll do pretty well for yourself. But there's not many people who can pull it off the way he can.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. Like one of the things that it's very very difficult in salary negotiations or if you're a contractor in rate negotiations, is that nobody wants to throw out the first number. You know, both sides want the other person to do it.
So, Marco, how do you figure out what you're worth?
That's a good question. I think one of the easiest ways to figure it out, if you can, like, you can go to like salary.com and all those weird things that I've never found those to be particularly accurate. Really, what you really should do is just figure out what people make. Like, figure out specifically. Like, go to any other company. Like, if you can find other companies that are offering similar job posts that actually mention a salary in the job post, you can use that as kind of a reference point of roughly what it might be worth. Again, there's a lot of inaccuracy in there, but and every company is different. But if you can find out at all, like, what – I mean, I don't know if you – I wonder if it would be weird to just ask, like, you know, what's the average salary of your engineers here? I don't know.
But you know what? Honestly, if I was hiring in today's climate, I'm looking for somebody who's really good and I think I've found somebody – and if they came in and they were comfortable, like, openly talking about salary, openly saying, you know what, this is what I made at my last job, but really this is what I'd like to make. I'd feel really nice. You know, I'd feel really happy making this. I think that I'm worth it. And, you know, this is really what I'd like to make. You know, I would respect that. If they said to me, well, you know, what's the average salary? And I don't see why I wouldn't be willing to come. And I hired lots of people in my career. Mm-hmm. I would be fine saying, you know, this position pays in this range, or this is what somebody at this level. I've worked at very corporate companies with thousands of employees, and they actually had pay levels. It said you're coming in as a systems analyst 2 position. This
right.
position pays between $65,000 and $75,000 based on your experience.
Right. Yeah. Like if you're going into especially if you're going into the government or any kind of
right.
really big organization, you probably don't have a lot of negotiation room because they're probably like they've approved a hire of a certain type of employee, like you have a system sysadmin 2 or whatever, and that type has this particular probably very narrow range of what they are allowed to pay based on the HR and the finance and everything else, and so yeah, I guess yeah, I mean I'm not familiar with that world at all, but really like
you're better off.
I know.
You really are. You don't need to go through it to hate it.
That's good. That's good to know.
So what's our next subject here?
I wanted to talk about a quick little thing. I wrote a post a couple days ago about Android. refuting Fred Wilson's points. He's basically asserting, and I know Fred Wilson, he's a very nice guy, very smart. He's basically asserting that he believes Android is going to be the predominant platform for a while, for the future, and mobile smartphones. And he's saying that it's important for developers to develop on Android first. Like, think of that as your baseline. Instead of developing on iOS first, which most developers do these days for our kind of industry, develop on Android first and then maybe put it on iOS later or whatever. And I disagree with that for a number of reasons. I mean, I'm not going to go through it all now, but the idea that I wrote in my post is basically that I don't believe that the Android market share numbers right now are particularly stable. And there's a great post on a Simco today about this too, trying to predict mobile market share.
You got to love that a Simco guy.
Oh God, yeah, yeah, he's fantastic.
He's like if you and John Gruber had a love child.
Who liked math a lot.
Who liked math.
Yeah. Yeah, so he's fantastic. And what I like about him too, like anybody can call me and John Gruber fanboys and annoying and wrong because we're telling our opinion most of the time. But he's like, here's a bunch of data. And it's a lot harder to argue with it. I mean, can argue with data, but it's a lot harder. And he doesn't really candy coat it much. He's like, here's the numbers and here's what I think because of the numbers. And so it's very, very solid. But anyway, so I think it's irresponsible to make predictions about the future of the mobile OS market right now because it's so young and it's so volatile. And especially with Android in particular, I think a few things, as I talked about, like Verizon is one of the biggest factors here in the US. There's a lot about Android's market share that I think is either artificially or temporarily inflated. And I think Verizon...
So you're saying, if I understand this, you're saying you think that right now more people are actually using Android or it seems like more people are using Android?
I think a lot of people are using Android right now, but I'm casting doubt on how many I think of those people will be using it in the future.
And your example in your post here, great post, by the way. For once, I really agree with you. This is in your post called Time Bombs. Well, a lot of the time I don't.
Of course, but
you're
saying, agree with me all the time, it would be a very boring show.
It would. But here's your thing. My theory is that most people willing to jump carriers and break contracts if necessary, you write, for the iPhone already did so sometime in the last 3 years onto AT&T, and the remaining mainstream Verizon customers interested in the iPhone are far more likely to wait for their contracts to expire before switching. You're saying this is right. They're using an Android phone because they wanted to be or needed to be on Verizon, and it was more or less like the closest to an iPhone they could get.
Right, like their contract was up because Verizon customers get new phones. I think it's supposed to be every 2 years, but they because that's when they offer you the new subsidies so that you can pay almost nothing for the phone. But then I think they have these early bird discounts. They used to do this where you can actually get it a few months before your contract is up. So. And I know globally the average smartphone ownership is 18 months. I don't know specifically what it is on Verizon or what it is in the U.S., but the idea is in the U.S. a lot of people buy phones on 2-year contracts, but most of the time they get new phones a little more often than every 2 years because a lot of times the old ones break or they lose them or for whatever reason they have to replace it mid-cycle. And then all the carriers do these little jump-the-gun things where you can get a discount if you re-up your contract a few months early just to lock you in for the 2 years. So, yeah, my theory – so Fred's point was that he believes that we've already seen the impact of the Verizon iPhone that now it's been out for 2 months. We've seen the impact in the market share numbers, and the market share numbers aren't that different. Android is still ahead of iOS in the U.S., and therefore Android's going to win. And I think it's a bit early to jump the gun on that. First of all, it's just not nearly enough time. And I think I got an email from somebody. I think the numbers he cited weren't even recent enough to include most of the sales from the last 2 months. So they don't even include most of the Verizon iPhones that have been sold. But we know. I know from looking at my numbers from what people are using. And I don't think anyone's really arguing this. We know that the Verizon iPhone didn't have a massive burst of sales at the beginning. But we also know that it's selling pretty close to what the AT&T phone is selling in daily sales. I think some store people leaked some numbers and we've seen these, but something like that. But it's selling, like, there's almost as many Verizon iPhones selling per day as AT&T iPhones in the U.S. And Android has had a similar sales pattern, which is there was not really any big burst of Android sales for any of the devices right up front. There were no big lines around every Verizon store waiting to get the new Droid X or whatever. It has a very similar sales pattern, which is the kind of normal casual buyers. Like, they go into the store. A lot of times they don't know what they're going to get before they get to the store. Their contract is up. They go to the store. They look at all the phones and they say, oh, you know, they know what the iPhone is. They see these Android phones and they say, ah, these look pretty good. This is probably good enough. This is probably just like an iPhone. So they get that. I mean, this is just a theory, but I've talked to a lot of like normal non-geek people who this happened to all of them. So many, like, you know, you go to family get-togethers and all the people have weirdo Verizon Android devices and they're like, oh, look, this is kind of cool. It kind of does this thing, but it dies in 40 minutes. and yeah, it's like the iPhone, right? And these are people who, you know, you have to look at why they're using Android. And are they using Android because they love Android or because it was the most iPhone-like thing in the Verizon store when they went to go buy a new phone? And there are certainly a lot of people who are using it because they love Android, but that's not all of them in all likelihood. And so by looking at Android's market share numbers alone and not considering these other factors, you can conclude that it's getting very, very popular. But its future popularity depends a lot on why it's getting popular today.
So here, let me give you an analogy of this. Here in the great state of Florida, where I'm still a resident for another month, hurricane season rolls around every year. Whenever it looks like there's a hurricane coming, everybody, and you probably have something like this when it snows up there, maybe if it's a bad one, people flood. They all immediately go out and they start buying bottled water.
Yep.
And they buy up, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, they fill a whole cart with bottled water at a buck a bottle, maybe $2 a bottle if they go for the, you know, the Zephyr Hills stuff. And they buy this and they bring it back home. And then when the hurricane, you know, turns right, like the last minute, now they've got all this water they got to, you know, use up, taking up space in their garage and their fridge. But if you were looking at the trend during that time and you weren't, you know, maybe even if you knew about the hurricane, but if you were just looking at the trend, it would say, hey, bottled water, everybody loves it. These big jugs are selling like crazy. When in this situation, it's just stretched out over a much, 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 much longer period of time. And the curve isn't quite as extreme of purchases. But you're saying everybody went out and got these things, but they didn't get them because they wanted them. They get them because this is something they needed. And what they really wanted was just to know they were going to have something good. I mean, in this case, water. That's kind of where the analogy breaks down. But you're saying that when these contracts are up, that they're going to make a different choice, and their choice is going to be the iPhone. And maybe when the iPhone 5 comes out, by then their contracts are up. Now, I just want to throw this out there. Just going to throw out that little question. We've all heard that at least it's sort of a rumor. We won't know for sure, but and I think we talked about this. No iPhone 5, no hardware, in fact, at WWDC, no iOS of any kind. Some people are saying that it's because the cameras in that apparently the Sony guy leaked. The camera is made by Sony for the iPhone 5, and where it's made and who it's made by are all in Japan, and those people were affected by the tsunami, and that's why the iPhone 5 is being delayed, because the manufacturer of the great camera that's going to be in there isn't going to be in time. That's one theory. What if the other theory is they actually want to push it out a little bit later to make sure that people who were on AT&T and subscribed to that, they want to give them time for their contracts to expire?
I don't think Apple really cares when people's contracts expire. I really don't. I think the tsunami thing, that could be a true story about Sony being delayed with the camera sensors, but I don't think that's what's causing the release date of the iPhone 5 to not be in June, assuming this is all true. Because, you know, as I said, like, you know, I wrote this last week too, like, assuming the iPhone 5 is coming out in June requires you to ignore a couple of inconvenient truths. You know, like that, that first of all, that why launch the Verizon one only 5 months before that?
Mm.
That's a little weird to have this other one on the channel 5 months early. Like, yes, they're going to get 5 months more of market share, but as we're seeing, that doesn't really matter that much.
Okay.
And so, you know, they could have launched it. They could have just waited until the iPhone 5 to say, we're also on Verizon. It wouldn't have made that much of a difference, relatively.
I hear that.
And then similarly, why, if the white iPhone 4 is actually still going to come out this spring, which only a few months ago, I think Schiller said that, or somebody said that on one of the earnings calls, they're still saying it's going to come out this spring. And they said that very recently. So if that's the case, why ship the white iPhone like in April? It's already April. It's not out yet. Why ship that a few months before it's going to be replaced by a new model? It doesn't make a lot of sense for so many reasons. Manufacturing, retail, inventory. Like, there's so many reasons why that just doesn't make a lot of sense. Marketing. I mean, there's tons of reasons. So it does seem like the iPhone 5 release schedule wasn't a recent decision. So it probably, the tsunami with supply chain with Sony, that might be true, but that probably isn't why it's not being shipped in June, if it isn't being shipped in June.
Hmm.
This sounds like the kind of thing they planned out, you know, probably a year ago. For whatever reason, maybe they're doing a really big jump. Maybe they're waiting for a certain LTE chipset to be useful, or a certain, you know, just a new phone chipset.
It's all planned. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, I really don't think that, you know, if everything we've heard is true, again, that's a big if, but if this is all true, I don't think that they only recently learned that they weren't going to ship the iPhone 5.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they have a really big operation going there. They have these phones in the pipeline for years. They have manufacturing and parts acquisitions in place way ahead, months ahead of time of a launch. So I really don't think that this is like, oh crap, we have to delay this for a few months now, and they just learned about this now. I really doubt that. Another thing could just be that they want to get out of the expectation that they're going to release a new iPhone every year at WWDC. That very well just might be, you know, that just might be, it's inconvenient for them for all the same reasons why they stopped going to Macworld.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were then kind of tying themselves to this expected release schedule, and then if they didn't satisfy that, you know, it just hurts them really. It puts a lot of pressure on them to satisfy an artificial schedule that is not always going to be in their best interest to satisfy.
Right. They're certainly in a position now where they don't have to worry about that. They don't have to stress out about that. Why impose yet another deadline that's arbitrary? Why not decouple the developer event from a physical hardware release of a device and focus more on, oh, this year is, you know, we're going to be talking about Lion. So that's the event here, and a few months later we'll hold a big press event and we'll come out with the new iPhone. It's separate, you know, a separate thing.
Exactly. And the other thing is too, and I mentioned this too, I'm sorry, this whole episode has been about my own blog post. That's really horrible.
It's a good post.
You know, the other part of that is every year the iPod event in the fall seems like it gets less and less interesting, because the iPods are less and less interesting, because so many former iPod owners are now just using the iPod app on their phone,
right?
Or they're using an iPod Touch, and even the iPod Touch, it does get updated at those events, but it's never surprising, because it's just like whatever phone was released a few months prior at WWDC, it's probably going to have the same base components, the same CPU, RAM, screen, probably the same graphics, in some kind of thinner, cheaper package. Like, they've done the exact same thing now for a few years, so it. Like, the iPod event in the fall isn't really newsworthy anymore. And so if you look at this, and I don't necessarily think that they want to launch the iPhone and the iPad at the same event. So, like, there's rumors, like, John Gruber had his hunch about there being, like, a fall iPad update, maybe the iPad Pro or iPad HD. And there have been a couple other rumors that have, as far as I can tell, just been based on his speculation, on his feeling about that. I don't think anybody has any information on that.
Yeah.
But I don't think it makes sense to consolidate them into one big event, because then iOS is only newsworthy once a year. and there's only the big lines around the block once a year. Mm-hmm. And I don't really think that would be good for anybody. It certainly wouldn't be good for Apple. It wouldn't be good for any of our credit card bills. It definitely would not be good for a lot of people. So I definitely think the iPad and the iPhone are going to be separate, because those are like their two big product lines going forward that are going to be newsworthy for a while to come. And so I think having the you can actually look at that and say, well, the iPad 2 just came out a couple weeks ago. And this is pretty close to June. It's already April.
Yeah.
We're pretty close to June, where the phone was supposed to be announced, supposedly. What if it's just more convenient for them press-wise to space out a bit more, to say, we're going to start releasing the iPads every spring and the iPhones every fall. That way they're about 6 months apart from each other. They're that about evenly spaced during the year. And you know, the press and the anticipation and the lines and the mania can all be more evenly spread throughout the year to keep everybody interested in their products. That variable could be the answer. Like, the iPods were helping them do that before, especially positioned before the holiday season.
Right.
The iPods were doing that before, but I think the iPods are becoming a lot less relevant fairly quickly. And because, you know, who cares what the next iPod Nano looks like, really? I know now I'm going to get an email from every iPod Nano owner. I still use one because it's small and I can make a watch out of it. That's cool. But, you know, most new iPods coming out, it's probably not going to be on CNN anymore, you know. But whenever there's a new phone or a new iPad, that's like headline news in the mainstream.
Oh yeah,
people know about it. Like, people who aren't geeks like us, like your parents will ask you about it. Like, everyone hears about it. Consumer Reports will make some dumb post about how horrible it is because they're addicted to page views from the internet now. You know, that's big news. But no one's really doing that for the iPods anymore. That's only a very recent thing. Only the last year or two had that really been the case. But I think the iPods are kind of done. Like, they're still going to update them, of course, but I think they're going to be about as interesting as the Airport Express. It's going to be these things that, you know, the tech
sites and the tech blogs and maybe the tech prints, they'll have an update, but it's just sort of an aside. Do you think, saying we shouldn't expect any new iPods, any new iPod devices ever? Like, this is it now?
No, I wouldn't say that. And I mean, I should definitely clarify that I have no sources and no information whatsoever. I'm not one of these powerhouse Apple bloggers who has sources. Everything I say is based on 100% speculation almost all the time. Chances are anything I know, everyone else knows too. So that being said, I really don't see the iPod line being updated every year. Or at least it could be a lot like the Shuffle, where the Shuffle has, with a couple of exceptions, been basically the same product for its entire life. It's, you know, they keep changing the shape of it, but with that one exception of the one they don't like to talk about that had no buttons.
Yeah.
with the one exception of that, it's been the exact same product. Just, you know, they keep making it a little bit smaller each time, but it's the same product. It's the same limitations, a lot of the same bugs. I hate the Shuffle. I've owned three of them and have hated them all.
Yeah.
The iPod Classic obviously is going nowhere. I think it's obvious that they're going to keep selling it because there is a market for people who just absolutely, for whatever reason, they feel like they must have their entire collections with them all the time. That's always going to be a market. I think the Nano is the everything else iPod for people who still don't want something as big or expensive or as fragile as a Touch. So the Nano, you know, I think they're all going to be around. The Touch definitely, of course, is going to be around.
Yeah.
I think they're all going to be around for a while, but, you know, who really cares what they're like in 2 years besides the Touch? Like, the Nano, I think the new one, they did some experiments, but it doesn't even seem like Apple cares that much anymore what the Nano is like. I mean, I'm sure the team that works on it will disagree with that, but it just seems like it's not that high of a priority because, you know, not a lot of people are really that interested in buying the Nano anymore, or the Shuffle, or the Classic especially.
So listen, let me tell you about our second sponsor. It's MailChimp. I love it. Do you do newsletters?
You know, I don't. I probably should. Newsletters are really good for software developers.
People always think the newsletters are like old fashioned, but they're really not.
Oh, they're really good. Like, they, first of all, I think geeks like us dramatically underestimate how effective they are at marketing to your existing customer base. So if you have a mailing list for your customers and you just released a new version, a lot of times they want to know about that. They want you to send them an email especially if they've explicitly signed up for it, they would love to get an email saying, hey, there's a new version out. Here's a link to go look at it. Maybe it's an upgrade fee, $10, go get it, whatever the case may be. They actually like that. And software developers who are not from the App Store era, where we can't really do that, they will tell you how important those mailing lists are. That's one of their most valuable assets, because every time they release an upgrade, they hit the list, they tell everyone there's an upgrade, and they make a lot of money from upgrade revenue and a lot of happy customers saying, thank you, because I wouldn't have otherwise known about this.
So what are these guys then that are building iOS apps who are essentially cut off from their customers do? MailChimp has a solution for that.
That's great.
So this is what they call it. I loved it. It's called ChimpKit. And this is an API wrapper. And all you do, it lets you drop a mailing list signup form into your iOS app. So that you
Is this for real? Like, I didn't know. I honestly didn't know
I know you didn't know that, and that's why I was like,
you just made them like the most perfect ad ever.
I know. Isn't that funny? and I just so you know, we did not plan this. Marco was not coached.
I think it's more perfect now because that was actually sincere.
It was. And well, so this is what they do. It lets you can get email addresses within the app, and you can have them automatically added to your MailChimp lists through the app. And it includes the standard, you know, sign up form code. You're just dropping it in without any modification, or you can style it to look like the rest of your app, whatever you want to do. But it lets you, you know, you can stay in touch with your users. You can keep them posted about updates to the app or updates, new apps that you come out with, whatever it is you're developing, you can tell them this. And keep in mind that MailChimp is free for lists with up to 2,000 subscribers. So unless you have more than 2,000 people subscribing, it's going to be free. And once you get over that, it's very affordable. We use them for everything. Go to MailChimp.com/ChimpKit, and you will hear, you will be able to sign up there and integrate it. And it's free. I mean, it's free code. It's on GitHub. It's all hooked up. So go check that out. And that's the thing. That is like you no longer have to be cut off from your users. You can find out. Now, some users may not want to do it, but if they understand that maybe there's you know, they're getting the inside info. So I was going to...
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's neat integration.
So last week, we talked about static file-based blogging systems.
Yeah, the second crack.
And so throughout the week, I kind of had this idea that I wanted to pretty much finish and release it before this week's show. And then you had, for some reason, I was assuming that you and I were kind of competing in this. I think you sent me an email like on Thursday or sometime like kind of midweek saying HiveLogic is done.
Yes.
And you didn't really explain what it's done with. And I think you mentioned Ruby on Rails or something. And so I was under the impression that you had just built your entire own static blogging system in 3 days using Ruby on Rails.
Well, I could have.
And HiveLogic was running on it. So then that kind of lit a fire under me to really try to finish mine. And so I tried a lot to finish mine. I didn't finish it. I don't think this kind of thing is ever finished.
No.
But I did get it to a demoable state for at least the reading end of it. The publishing end still needs a lot of work, and there's a couple issues I want to talk about there.
Well, first of all, let me apologize for sending that that erroneous message. I didn't mean it. When we were talking last week on the show, I was saying, you know, why wouldn't you use something already built like Jekyll or Webby or Nanoc or whatever, however you say that. I build from scratch. I said, okay, I didn't mean to imply that I was also going to build mine from scratch, but I did. I used Jekyll.
Yeah, so I get an email like 2 days later saying,
it's done.
I got Jekyll up and running.
Yeah. Yeah, so I used Jekyll, and because I'm too old to write my own stuff now. I have to let the young kids do this. No, I'm just kidding. That wasn't why. It was a time thing for me. I really did want to write it. And I debated it, and I looked at what was out there, and I said, you know what, Jekyll does pretty much everything that I'm going to want to do. There's some things I don't like about it, and there's still a chance that I may write my own anyway, because really the only part of it that I would need to write is a transformation engine. Not getting too niggly about it, but what I don't like about Jekyll is that it regenerates the whole site every single time, and I really only want to regenerate what's changed.
Mine does that.
What, regenerates the whole thing?
Oh, mind regenerates only what's changed.
Well, see, because that's the right way to do it. But Jekyll, and you know what? Maybe here comes the email. Maybe there's like a way to do it. Please tell me if there's a way to just have it do what's changed. I can't. I haven't, you know, to be honest, I haven't even looked that much into it. It might be possible for me to just add that. But again, I just wanted to do this. I just wanted to get it done. So I spent probably a total, you know, because I've got a kid and I've got this five by five thing and other the move and everything else going on. Moving to Austin. I don't know if I've said that on this show. In the next month or so. So, you know, I said, what's the quickest, easiest, most simple and direct path to getting this done?
Well, to be fair, during this week, my wife was out of town and we have a 3-month-old puppy. And so my time was also fairly constrained. Not as much as yours, I would imagine.
The puppies do take a lot of time. They're always peeing on everything, right?
Exactly. And I managed to go 3 straight days, no accidents in the house. I was very proud of that.
Can you diaper train? Can you potty train it? I guess you have to potty train
probably
it. You can't
not.
Put a diaper on it.
You can potty train cats, but I don't like cats, so that's a different story. But so during this week, I was you know, working my butt off to try to get this done, like in a few hours here and there. Not to mention, you know, my other jobs,
right?
Piece to paper, you know, writing on my site, which I guess isn't really a job, but anyway. So I was able to make a system. It was actually a lot more difficult than I thought it would be. It was a lot more work. It's still not a lot of code. As I said last week, my goal was to make something that was very little code and had very little dependencies. And my idea was the Dropbox-based posting. Now, for the live listeners, you can actually go to secondcrack.marco.org and see a preview of this right now. It's only you don't see the publishing end of it because there isn't one yet. But I spent a lot of the time just kind of playing with the file structure, seeing where I wanted to put things. I spent too much time writing a template engine that ended up being fairly buggy. And really, I was basically reimplementing XSL, but I really shouldn't have. And then I remembered that PHP is a template engine. And so it was like there's a lot of reasons to have template engines. Instead of just using raw PHP as your template, like having a template file that has PHP code in it that iterates through whatever content and renders it out. A lot of those reasons for not doing that are if you're running a hosted service, like on Tumblr, they have to have a template engine because they can't have users entering and executing native PHP. That would be bad. Or if you want your templates to be editable by somebody who is not necessarily a PHP programmer or a programmer of whatever language you're writing them in, so you can simplify the language, you can restrict what it does, what it has access to. In this kind of context, though, neither of those were the case. The person writing the template was me, and it's a PHP engine. Presumably people running it will and it's so unfriendly to run so far, to set up at least. It's so unfriendly that I imagine most people who ever are going to run this code are going to be programmers. And the issue of access and security is far less important in this context because, again, this isn't something that the public can just go create a hosted blog and execute code in my service. This is like you are downloading this code and running it on your own server, on your own computer. So it's the security implications are far less. And what I'm also doing, which helps security a lot, I think, is there's no PHP executed in the web root. Like there are no PHP files in the web root at all. Maybe I mean you could put one there if you wanted to, but it wouldn't be part of this application. It'd be a standalone thing. The web root is only the output generated files, and then a pretty clever htaccess file to make some of the redirects work. But that's about it. So one thing that I ran into that I think is interesting to talk about. Last week I mentioned that my original idea was to store all the source files, like the markdown source files. To store them on Dropbox. And that way, anything that can edit on Dropbox can then publish to my blog. And I can use any Dropbox connected to computer or any Dropbox app on the iPad, et cetera, to edit and publish to the blog. And so last night, I was racing to set up the server so I could have this up to demo today. And I looked up installing Dropbox on Linux, and they have a Linux client. And I tried it out, and then it downloaded all of my, like, you know, it to run Dropbox on Linux, it's very similar to how you wrote on a computer. You download the client, you install it, you authorize it, and then it downloads your Dropbox folder to that computer.
So now you've got all your Dropbox stuff up on there.
Yeah, now I have like my Dropbox documents, my one password, like all that stuff is now on my web server.
Do you want to know how you get around that?
Well, hold on. So then anybody who hacked into my web server would have any document I have in Dropbox.
Yeah, like, terrible plan.
My one password file is there, which I know is encrypted, but still, like that's you still would rather keep that.
I'm hacking your server right now.
Well, it's not there now. Oh. I took it. But so you know, all those things are there, and that's weird for me with security. Like I like having the servers be. Obviously, I secure the servers as much as I know how to. But why put that there if it doesn't need to be there?
Correct.
And I looked, and they have an exclude feature. Is this what you were going to tell me to avoid it?
No.
Okay. Well, they you can exclude certain files or directories, but if you have access to the server, you can just tell it to stop excluding them, and then it'll download it. So yeah,
that's not what I was going to tell you.
That doesn't do it. And if you have a Dropbox API script.
Oh, that's cumbersome.
That downloads from Dropbox.
So what did you do? What's your solution?
I don't know yet. Right now, this
can I tell you what the solution is?
Well, this directory is rsynced. I'm just running the software locally on my
rsync,
Mac.
Rsync works, but can I tell you the Dropbox solution?
Yeah, please do.
I'll tell you how I'm doing this.
Oh, now, is it a public folder?
No. Although that's not a bad idea, but no. So here's the way that I did this. Again, same situation. I don't want all that stuff up on the server. That doesn't make any sense. I don't want, you know, personal stuff up on some random hackable, potentially hackable server. Right. So what, I mean, you hope not. Like you said, you do everything you can to secure something, but here's how you do it. It's relatively straightforward. Basically, you create a second Dropbox account, and it doesn't, you know, matter what you name it, what you call it, whatever. And then you share a folder in that Dropbox account with your regular Dropbox account, and it becomes a folder in your own local Dropbox folder. So then anything
right to it.
Right. So you know you in fact you never have to log in from your local machine with that Dropbox folder ever. You never need to log in with that account, rather, ever. The only thing that ever logs into that account is the server. And that one, there's only needs to be one folder, or maybe you have a folder for each of the sites that you do. And I created a sites folder, and inside of there I have HiveLogic.
Yeah, that's a genius solution.
And then, it seemed like the only way to do it that felt secure to me. Any other way, it felt like I was putting everything out there. So now if I wanted to
make... I
never
realized they had shared folders where like two people could write to the same folder.
Yeah. Now the only thing to remember about that is let's say I wanted to share a whole folder of stuff with you. I could share it. That folder could be totally private and only we could see it, but it counts against both of our storage things. So if you only have 100 megs of space and I only have 100 megs and we both upload 50 megs, it's not like it's riding on yours or riding on mine. We both get the 50 meg hit. Yeah. But that's
Dropbox is one of those services that I'm still
so good.
I still don't use it for enough stuff size wise that I need to pay money. I think I have whatever the base is where I haven't spammed everyone I know with referral links. So I think it's like 2 gigs or 5 gigs, whatever the base storage is. That's all I have right now.
Yeah.
I would love a reason to buy more storage. Like I would love a reason to start paying the money because they're just that good.
Yeah.
Right, I only use a few hundred megs on it now, but
yeah. So anyway, that is the ultimate. I think the ultimate way to do it is basically
my whole blog is only 500 megs, and most of that is images and a couple audio files.
So with this, I synced up the whole thing in both the external, and then all you have to do is wherever you decide to put that Dropbox folder, you point your Apache or Nginx server. You just point it at the whatever the output folder, which in Jekyll is the _ site folder, that is your web root. And it doesn't matter where it lives. Apache or Nginx just pointed at that. And you're up and you're running in business. And then that way, locally on your own machine, your own Mac or PC or Linux box, all of a sudden there's a new little folder there called sites with HiveLogic in it. And that's where you run everything. And with symlinks, you can make it work just the way you want by symlinking that folder to your work folder where you keep all your things. And plus I'm using GitHub for this, so I can, you know, it's actually a Git project that's pushed up there too. So that's the way you want to do it. You got to do it like that.
That is a much better solution.
rsync isn't bad, but it requires you, and then you've got to do the cron job.
Right. See, the problem with rsync is that I don't want to have, like, I want to be able to blog from any computer or from my iPad. With rsync, I was thinking, like, okay, I'll have Dropbox still be the source, and then I'll just have my Mac Pro at home, which is always on in theory and always connected in theory, blogging. But then, like, if my Mac Pro isn't always on,
yeah,
then I can't blog, you know. And so that I really didn't want to do that. And with if I had Dropbox on the server, then I can have a cron script that runs, you know, once a minute. See, the reason I designed my system to do incremental updates, like, it only updates files that need to be updated.
That's very good.
Including all the indexes, the tag pages. And so I'm doing a lot here. If you look at my demo, the secondcrack.marker.org, there's a little thing. If you scroll to the bottom, you can see how I do archives. I don't do infinite pagination because that's just way too hard. Because then, like, if you can just go to, like, you know, page 245, and that's like the first page of your blog, then every time you add a post, you have to rebuild every page, because then every page gets shifted down by one.
Right.
And I was looking at Daring Fireball for some inspiration on how to solve this problem, because I know movable type uses static files. And so I basically copied the way that's done. So I have, and please forgive the formatting of the of this on my test blog, but I have at the bottom of each page just archives. Every month, that's it. You can also do, if you see, I'm following the permalink structure of the traditional blog of /year/month/day/slug. And the months are navigable. The days, I don't think are, no, the days are not yet, but the months are navigable. So if you go to like /2011/03, that shows an index page of all the posts in that month. So a very simple archive. I haven't decided yet which chronological direction to order those posts in. Right now they are forward chronological, which means they're the opposite direction that you see on the front page. But you can then scroll down and read the month in order. I haven't decided yet whether that's a good idea. But I also have every post has one type and any number of tags. And each type and each tag has its own RSS feed and archives. So you can see in the test links section, in my little sidebar there, I have a best of, text post, links, quotes. You can see that those are best of is a tag, and then text post, links, and quotes are types. And types can have their own rendering, their own themes. They get their own RSS feeds automatically. The RSS for anything is just secondcrack.whatever/rss.xml, or I think it's like tag bestof.xml. Does that work? Yes, that does. So if you take any of the URLs for the tags and types of their bases, not their archives, then you can add .xml, and that's the RSS version. So very, very simple. Everything's being generated on the fly. And so what I was timing. There's a lot of performance here, performance considerations, so that on my Mac Pro, I haven't tried this on the server yet, but on the Mac Pro, running a full update job that checks for changed files, if there's nothing to update, takes less than half a second.
Fast.
And this is on my all my imported blog data, which is 5,800 posts, roughly. So 1,500 posts, a few images, lots of images that go with them. But yeah, so half a second to scan through all those posts and all the images and see if any of these files changed. So the idea was I can run this like, you know, every 10 seconds. Who cares? I can run it. It can run a lot. But there's also, if Dropbox is doing the work, there is a tool, I forget the name of it. It's some kind of cron variant, like cron I or something. It's some kind of cron variant that will run a command every time the contents of a directory change. And so ideally, I haven't tried this yet, but ideally I would have that run on the Dropbox directory and
That'd
execute this every time a source file changed. And then the Dropbox directory isn't hosting the live site necessarily. I mean, there's no reason why it couldn't. I'm sure it could. But the source files and the live site are different directories. So the way I have it set up now, so that you can have this, you can have the live site on, you know, on your server and be fine. It's very separate, so you can just rsync that over somewhere if you wanted to. I initially thought that it would be cool to have this be able to export to S3.
Yeah,
S3 recently added static files.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant.
Well, I decided not to for a few reasons. I mean, I could always add it later. there'd be a few things that wouldn't work right without additional work, but I'm sure, you know, I could add it later. The reason I wasn't crazy about doing that is because S3's bandwidth pricing is really bad.
Yeah.
And like for this kind of content, S3, the pricing is amazing for bulk storage. That's why it's great to use like for backups, for instance. S3 is awesome for storing lots of data very, very cheaply. But the bandwidth pricing is not great. So chances are most blogs don't serve enough traffic to really matter in that way. But if you're hosting a very popular blog, which you probably would be if you're even considering S3 as a hosting platform, it's not great for that. And also, historically, I use S3 a lot at Tumblr because all the media is there. And I generally saw, and we did eventually switch to a CDN up front in front of it just for a lot of savings and performance. S3 was not great for serving a lot of small files because there's a certain latency involved in each request that it's not bad, but you can do a lot better with pretty much any other way of serving those files. S3 is really great for serving like big files, like audio, video files, even like full-size images, it's fine. But if you're trying to load a blog page that has a bunch of small images here and there, or just even if you just want the index page to load really quickly, S3 is not the best solution for that. It just has a little bit too much per request latency. And S3 has the advantage in that you pay only for what you use, but really like most blogs are going to use very little. So you might think that it's going to be very, very inexpensive to host an unpopular blog there. But I think if your blog is that unpopular, you might want to just consider WordPress or Tumblr or any other hosted solution at that point. But I think, just shared hosting with just rsyncing these files up to it or FTPing these files to it would also be very, very cheap. Like the cheapest Dreamhost account in the world, that can do this no problem. And so I'm not that worried about S3 being that much in demand. Anyway, what do you think about that? I don't know.
No, I think those are great points. I think there's very few people who have as much experience in the intersection of S3 and blogging the way you do. I agree. I think S3's biggest strength is in bulk data storage right now. The transfers and the rates that they charge are very expensive.
Yeah.
Storing, I use them as a backup, and I can give you an idea that I sync all of the exported files for 5x5, all of the MP3s and everything else. I mean, every single one we've done for every show from day one. So it's like almost, a year and a half plus of all of our stuff. I think it's like $10 a month to store that up there.
Yeah,
but to serve it, it is literally thousands of dollars a month. Thousands. We have a lot. I mean, we're lucky. We have a lot of downloads. It's a good problem to have to pay a lot in bandwidth. But I mean, that's when it gets really, really, really expensive.
Right.
Painfully and S3, expensive.
It's also not that reliable. Like it is reliable compared to most, individual hosting methods. But it's not significantly better.
Right.
I've seen lots of problems with S3. I mean, especially at Tumblr, it was a big deal because we would write all the media files there. So if you uploaded a photo, it was written to S3 immediately. And so if S3 couldn't be written to, it was a big problem for Tumblr. And so I became very familiar with its uptime and limitations. And again, it's pretty good. Most of the time, it's pretty good. But everyone assumes that it's just always going to be up, and that's not the case. I mean, that's not the case for anything. But it's not going to be significantly better for you than a web server for serving a blog. Yeah. Again, if you're serving lots of other things, big media files, that's a different story. But most blogs will be perfectly fine being served from the amount of bandwidth that you get from your hosting. Like whenever you buy hosting through anybody who's not Amazon, you get a certain amount of bandwidth included per month. And you will probably not exceed that if you're being at all reasonable with like your images and media files that you're uploading. You'll probably fit very comfortably within the bandwidth you're given.
Right.
One thing I'm curious about, and I'm hoping maybe listeners can help with this, as I'm testing this system, I want to be able to stress test it to see if for instance, certain Apache configurations or certain caches in front of it to try to test the limits of like how much a base level Linode or slice host slice can handle traffic. And I'm curious to know if you know, Dan, or if our listeners know, good tools or good ways to stress test that. The only really good way I know about that is like using Apache Bench AB from a few different places. But I suspect that the limitation there is going to be the things that are fetching. And I'm going to hit a limit of how much they can fetch, or latency is going to cause limits. Or for some reason, I'll hit limits that I can't go above that for testing. And so, you know, I'm trying to, like, you know, pick the slowest possible server to test from, which is, you know, the tiniest VPS that I can find
right
on a hosted VPS service, and to see how much that can do. But I suspect, again, that I'm going to have limitation on the client side. So if anyone has suggestions, I'd love to hear them. You know, feel free to do the 5x5 feedback form. That'd be cool.
Yeah, I sure don't know. I'd love to hear that too. So that's it, though, right? Anything else? It's a good show.
I think so. Yeah, man, that action the two packed. Dropbox accounts thing with the shared folder, that's going to be great.
Yeah, try that out. I'd love to hear. And there, a lot of people have been asking me about that. And of course, you know, don't feel like you have to use Jekyll just because I did try some of the other ones. People have emailed me, well, what was wrong with this one?
And
well,
oh, no, I'm not going to try them.
No, you won't. I was talking more to the listeners.
Listeners. Yeah,
I mean, try whatever you want. I'm not saying you need to go use Jekyll. I'm saying that's the one that I had kind of used before and had some familiarity with. So here's the big question for you. Are you going to be releasing yours? Are you going to put it out there on GitHub? And are you not ready yet? When can we expect this thing?
I still haven't decided for sure whether I'm going to use it. But if I use it, I will release it. And it will be on GitHub. It's already on GitHub. It's just private.
Oh, well, you won't release it even if you don't use it? Like for other people to learn from?
I guess I could.
You should.
I guess I didn't consider that. I didn't think anybody would really care. I mean,
come on. People are dying to see your code.
Well, but that's a big reason not to release it. I really want to set expectations low here. This code is not great. It's certainly rushed, and it's not meant for a ton of expandability. And critically, it's also very, very minimally documented or commented, because I know I'm going to get hell for this. I don't comment a lot of my code. Usually I prefer to structure the code in such a way that it's fairly obvious what it's doing. I'm careful with things like variable names and function names and structure, and I'm fairly consistent with the structure of my functions and my classes. And so I don't usually write comments. I'm not saying I never comment my code, but I have very few comments in my code. And I also never use documentation tools. It's not that I inherently dislike them. I never have used them. And I hate like when you use some of those automatic documenter things, you have to put these tremendous headers above all of your functions that look ugly as hell in the source file and just are unreadable in the source file. That drives me crazy. So I don't use documentation tools. I don't use a lot of comments in the code. I hope the code is self-explanatory. Anyway, hey, if it's on GitHub, anybody else is welcome to go document it for me. I can't imagine a task that most programmers would want to do less than that. But you're welcome to try. The other thing is I wrote this awesome XML template engine that doesn't work. So anybody's welcome to fix it. The problem is it mostly works, but I was just getting a few little weird behaviors, and I could tell there's some bugs that I just really don't feel like tracking down because I just figured I'd rather just do PHP templates. And the PHP template is actually far easier and far more more dynamic because it can do all the PHP logic. It can format things the whatever it wants. It can do string manipulation. You know, it can do all sorts of stuff. So, and I realized that my XML-based system would really be better off just being XSL and not being my little dumb language to try to write around it. So, because XSL is really good. XPath is amazing. And so it was just dumb to try to build my own when it was ending up to just be a bad version of XSL. even though I'm perfectly fine building my own entire blogging system that might end up being a bad version of Jekyll. That's different. I'm going to ignore that for now.
Right. Why do you think you might not use it? We'll end on this note. Why, you say if you use it, why not? Why wouldn't you use it?
The biggest thing, you know, when I explained in the last episode why I always wrote my own systems before I worked at Tumblr. And in effect, Tumblr was not that different because I was still writing it. So it was just a much bigger scale, a much more different product, obviously. But I always got a lot of satisfaction out of writing my own blogging system. And like the reason Tumblr had Markdown support added was because I really wanted to use Markdown. And I was able to convince David to let me add it. That's why. And, you know, the Smarty Pants support, like all that stuff. I basically added those things because I wanted to use them.
Right.
I even have a special rule in my blog that my URLs are shorter than everyone else's because they don't contain the word post. It's just slash number.
Right.
I've always kind of had that desire to hack my own code, even though there's lots of practical reasons not to write your own. And in this case, you know, if I were to move my blog to something that was not Tumblr, I would definitely incur some political problems.
Yeah.
You know, if there was a press story about it, that would be bad for Tumblr. It would probably be bad for me, and I don't want to piss anybody off. The fact is, I want to go back to writing my own blog system again. And from the time I left Tumblr to now, I haven't been able to do that because I no longer work there. I no longer can change anything about it.
Right.
And So there's a big political cost to me doing this if I choose to do it, potentially. I mean, it's also possible no one will notice or care. I would love for that to be the case. I would love if nobody noticed or cared.
Right.
I'm afraid somebody might, and so that's a big reason not to do it.
How would anyone know, though, if it was powered by Tumblr or not?
They would figure it. Trust me. Like, Business Insider would figure it out and post this awful headline.
Well, I believe you on that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a tough situation. Maybe you have to start a new blog then.
Well, certainly switching to my own instead of switching to a competitor is certainly easier for that. But again, like the reasons why I want to use my own have nothing to do with Tumblr.
Right.
Except for the fact that I don't work there anymore and therefore it's not my own anymore. So I think any press article would not make that distinction. They would find the inflammatory headline and run with it. So I definitely worry a lot about that. The other thing is there are a lot of advantages to using hosted platforms. There's a lot of features that I have to write for this to be easy to post to. Because right now you have to create a Markdown file in a certain directory and then run this cron script thing to update it. That precludes things like email posting from blog clients like Mars Edit. I was looking at the Meta Weblogs API. Possibly I'll implement that because it looks pretty simple. What you do with images, like when you're creating the post, how do you preview a draft post? That's a big thing. I preview my posts aggressively while I'm writing them, so I've been kind of brainstorming like how to do that in this kind of environment. I think I have an idea how to do it, but it's gonna be clunky, I think. So I'm still thinking about how to manage drafts and previewing. But yeah, drafts, previewing, image uploads, media uploads, any kind of, you know, the edit procedure, like things like that. It's a little, there's a lot of things that you don't think about when you're writing a new service or when you're writing a blogging thing that you have to deal with. Right now I think I have a handle on it, but I know as I keep going, I'm gonna keep finding things that I forgot about that I thought, oh crap, now I have to handle this case or this weird feature. So it's gonna be a lot of work, and I should probably be doing something else with my time. Realistically speaking, this is probably not a good use of my time.
Yeah.
But I'm a programmer, and this is what I do. I'm learning. I'm exercising my skills. I'm developing new skills. I'm developing experience, and so this is what I do. This is what makes me happy. And actually not doing this makes me very uneasy because I'm not doing it. You know, it's like when I write a blog post, writing to me is something I have to do on a regular basis. If I don't write for a while, I'll get antsy and I'll just have to write something. It's like taking a dump. Like, you just have to do it every so often, you know? And programming is the same way. And while I am programming in other things, like obviously I'm working on Instapaper, I've always programmed my blog. Always. As I said, like this has always been – and because it's something I'm creating that is running on software that I mostly wrote so far.
Yeah.
I see that as mine. I see that as one of my products, as one of my software outputs. And to not have that output be within my control anymore is unsettling to me. I have to have my own thing. I have to be able to do my own thing. And then in addition to just kind of the maintenance side of it like that, there's things I want to do that Tumblr doesn't offer that now I can't just go write. Before, I could just say, oh, this feature isn't in the API. I'll just go add it. You know, now I can't do that anymore. So I want that level of finer control, and I want another programming outlet the way I've always had one in this area. And now for the last 6 months or however long I've been gone, I haven't had it. And I'm getting a little itchy, a little antsy, you know? So that's mostly the reason why I'm doing it, even though it doesn't, like on paper, it doesn't make sense. Quick story. When I got my first car, it was a really awesome, it was a Maxima, nice luxury sedan, but an old one because it was used, and it was all the luxury options and a stick shift, and it was awesome. I loved it because I love driving stick shift. It was not very sensible though. It required premium gas, and it wasn't particularly reliable. I had to put a lot of money into that car. Just lots of things weirdly broke. It wasn't that efficient even with the premium gas it was given, and I drove it like a race car. But I loved driving that car. And then when I finally had to get rid of that, my next car was a Honda Accord. On paper, the Honda Accord is the most sensible car for me. It's extremely reliable. It was very efficient. It didn't need premium gas. I didn't even get the V6 because I wanted a sensible, economical car. And it was very nice, and it was indeed very sensible and very, very reliable and very economical. But I just felt nothing for it. I didn't enjoy driving. Oh, and I got an automatic, which was because I thought I needed one, which was terrible. I just felt nothing while driving that car. And so it was time for me to get another car last year. And I got one, and I got a stick. A sports car, and it's awesome. And it's not, it is still practical. It's still a four-door car. It's a nice sports sedan that's a stick that is too expensive and uses premium gas and has horrible gas mileage because I drive it like a race car. But every single time I drive, I drive that car, I love it. And I love driving, and I feel something. And so even though on paper it didn't make sense to get that, on paper I should have just gotten another Honda. But I wanted to feel something. And every time I get into that car, I feel it. And I ignore that it's inefficient and that it was expensive and that I should probably have gotten something better. Like there's probably something better I could have done with that money. Like that ridiculous blog post from the guy who said the iPad cost $2,000 because you should have been investing the money in your retirement instead.
Yeah, right.
Can you imagine that guy's life? I mean, he's like, he can't have very, very delightful.
Yeah, he's got to be a lot of fun at the dinner party. Wow.
Yeah, I mean.
That's a $2,000 investment in that phone.
Yeah, you know how much that would have been worth if you would have just saved that money for retirement?
Yeah.
And do you think the guy's actually going to have fun in his retirement? I doubt it. You know, I think he's going to be the same. He's always worried about the future. He's never living. So anyway, I chose to live with my car choice, even though on paper I shouldn't have. And I'm much happier for it. And therefore, I think it was the best decision that I could have made in that department because it made me happy every single day. The blogging system, I think, is similar. On paper, I really shouldn't be doing this. There's lots of reasons why I shouldn't be doing this. And I can just keep doing what I have been doing and just be a little bit dissatisfied and have this kind of discontent about the whole thing indefinitely. Or I can take the option I shouldn't take on paper and be really happy with it. Presumably. So I think I'm just going to do it.
And do it, man. Just do it.
Yeah, I should. And everyone should buy fun cars and drink awesome coffee.
And maybe next week I'll tell you my car philosophy. But we're out of time. We're already way over.
Yeah, I know. That's all right. I think it was worth it.
It's always worth it. Marco, oh, come on. Thanks.
To the chat room, you think I would buy a WRX? I'm way too old to drive a WRX. I'm 28. There is no way I can buy a WRX.
I don't even know what a WRX is.
It's a Subaru Impreza type that is very... It's very fast, and for its price, it's a very good value for the speed. And so it's very popular among young people who want the fastest car for the least amount of money possible. And so it's fine for that. I don't like the way it looks. I don't like the interior quality. But my priorities were not the most speed at the least price. So for that, it's fine. My priorities were I kept renting the 328 from Zipcar, and it was awesome, so I had to buy one. that was the decision there.
So. Yeah, I used to have a BMW 3 Series too.
Yeah, so you know.
Yeah.
My only regret is that I think I should have gone a little bit higher. I think I should have gotten the 335, even though, again, on paper, there's no reason to get it. You really shouldn't get 335 on paper. But I think for the next one, because this is a lease, I think for the next one, I'm going to get 335. But we'll see.
Next show.
Next show, yeah.
All right, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. You can hear previous episodes of this show by going to 5x5.tv. And there's other shows that are there. Of course, we have the talk show with John Gruber, Back to Work with Merlin Mann, Hypercritical with John Siracusa, and my daily show, The Daily Edition. And I think that's enough self-promotion. People always get on me. But let me remind you guys, don't forget, freshbooks.com. Go get your cake. Tell them you heard about it here. And MailChimp.com/ChimpKit so you can get back in touch with your users. Marco, have a great week.
You too.